the touch of a few buttons, reach out and touch the world. Fax broadcast computers churned press releases into the inboxes of radio, television, print, and internet media outlets from Maine to Moscow. Bulk email programs blanketed online newswires. Telephone auto-dialers phoned thousands of media content managers and played recorded voice announcements. A breaking news web page provided constant updates and pre-formatted content. The live feed-capable news sources, CNN, NBC, ABC, CBS, foreign syndicates, would be assaulted from all angles and promised free live television feeds. Whatever else these networks were airing would come to a screeching halt for an emergency presidential address. Full penetration. Like a general inspecting her troops, Tench strode in silence over to the copy desk and picked up the printout of the flash release that now sat loaded in all the transmission machines like cartridges in a shotgun. When Tench read it, she had to laugh quietly to herself. By usual standards, the release loaded for broadcast was heavy-handed, more of an advertisement than an announcement. But the president had ordered the communications office to pull out all the stops. And that they had. This text was perfect. Keyword rich and content light. A deadly combination. Even the news wires that used automated keyword sniffer programs to sort their incoming mail would see multiple flags on this one. From White House Communications Office. Subject, urgent presidential address. The President of the United States will be holding an urgent press conference tonight at 8 p.m. Eastern Standard Time from the White House briefing room. The topic of his announcement is currently classified. Live audiovisual feeds will be available via customary outlets. Laying the paper back down on the desk, Marjorie Tench looked around the communications office and gave the staff an impressed nod. They looked eager. Lighting a cigarette, she puffed a moment, letting the anticipation build. Finally, she grinned. "Ladies and gentlemen, start your engines." Chapter 53. All logical reasoning had evaporated from Rachel Sexton's mind. She held no thoughts for the meteorite, the mysterious GPR printout in her pocket, Ming, the horrific attack on the ice sheet. There was one matter at hand. Survival. The ice skimmed by in a blur beneath her like an endless sleek highway. Whether her body was numb with fear or simply cocooned by her protective suit, Rachel didn't know. But she felt no pain. She felt nothing. Yet. Lying on her side, attached to Tallinn at the waist, Rachel lay face to face with him in an awkward embrace. Somewhere ahead of them, the balloon billowed, fat with wind, like a parachute on the back of a dragster. Corky trailed behind, swerving wildly like a tractor trailer out of control. The flare marking the spot where they had been attacked had all but disappeared in the distance. The hissing of their nylon Mark IX suits on the ice grew higher and higher in pitch as they continued to accelerate. She had no idea how fast they were going now, but the wind was at least 60 miles an hour. And the frictionless runway beneath them seemed to be racing by faster and faster with every passing second. The impervious Mylar balloon apparently had no intentions of tearing or relinquishing its hold. "We need to release," she thought. They were racing away from one deadly force, directly toward another. The ocean is probably less than a mile ahead now. The thought of icy water brought back terrifying memories. The wind gusted harder, and their speed increased. Somewhere behind them, Corky let out a scream of terror. At this speed, Rachel knew they had only a few minutes before they were dragged out over the cliff into the frigid ocean. Tallinn was apparently having similar thoughts because he was now fighting with the payload clasp attached to their bodies. "I can't unhook us," he yelled. "There's too much tension." Rachel hoped a momentary lull in the wind might give Tallinn some slack, but the catabatic pulled on with relentless uniformity. Trying to help, Rachel twisted her body and rammed the toe cleat of one of her crampons into the ice, sending a rooster tail of ice shards into the air. Their velocity slowed ever so slightly. "Now!" she yelled, lifting her foot. For an instant, the payload line on the balloon slackened slightly. Tallon yanked down, trying to take advantage of the loose line to maneuver the payload clip out of the carabiners. Not even close. "Again!" he yelled. This time they both twisted against one another and rammed their toe prongs into the ice, sending a double plume of ice into the air. This slowed the contraption more perceptibly. "Now!" On Tallon's cue, they both let up. As the balloon surged forward again, Tallon rammed his thumb into the carabiner latch and twisted the hook, trying to release the clasp. Although closer this time, he still needed more slack. The carabiners, Nora had bragged, were first-rate, Joker safety clips, specifically crafted with an extra loop in the metal so they would never release if there were any tension on them at all. "Killed by safety clips," Rachel thought, not finding the irony the least bit amusing. "One more time," Tallon yelled. Mustering all her energy and hope, Rachel twisted as far as she could and rammed both of her toes into the ice. Arching her back, she tried to lift all her weight onto her toes. Tallon followed her lead until they were both angled roughly on their stomachs, the connection at the belt straining their harnesses. Tallon rammed his toes down and Rachel arched further. The vibration sent shockwaves up her legs. She felt like her ankles were going to break. "Hold it! Hold it!" Tallon contorted himself to release the Joker clip as their speed decreased. "Almost!" Rachel's crampons snapped. The metal cleats tore off of her boots and went tumbling backward into the night, bouncing over Corky. The balloon immediately lurched forward, sending Rachel and Tallon fishtailing to one side. Tallon lost his grasp on the clip. "Shit!" The Mylar balloon, as if angered at having been momentarily restrained, lurched forward now, pulling even harder, dragging them down the glacier toward the sea. Rachel knew they were closing fast on the cliff, although they faced danger even before the 100-foot drop into the Arctic Ocean. 3 huge snow berms stood in their path. Even protected by the padding in the Mark IX suits, the experience of launching at high speed up and over the snow mounds filled her with terror. Fighting in desperation with their harnesses, Rachel tried to find a way to release the balloon. It was then that she heard the rhythmic ticking on the ice, the rapid-fire staccato of lightweight metal on the sheet of bare ice. The axe. In her fear, she had entirely forgotten the ice axe attached to the ripcord on her belt. The lightweight aluminum tool was bouncing along beside her leg. She looked up at the payload cable on the balloon. Thick, heavy-duty, braided nylon. Reaching down, she fumbled for the bouncing axe. She grasped the handle and pulled it toward her, stretching the elastic ripcord. Still on her side, Rachel struggled to raise her arms over her head, placing the axe's serrated edge against the thick cord. Awkwardly, she began sawing the taut cable. "Yes!" Tallon yelled, fumbling now for his own axe. Sliding on her side, Rachel was stretched out, her arms above her, sawing at the taut cable. The line was strong, and the individual nylon strands were fraying slowly. Tallon gripped his own axe, twisted, raised his arms over his head, and tried to saw from underneath in the same spot. Their banana blades clicked together as they worked in tandem like lumberjacks. The rope began fraying on both sides now. "We're going to do it," Rachel thought. "This thing is going to break." Suddenly, the silver bubble of Mylar before them swooped upward, as if it had hit an updraft. Rachel realized, to her horror, that it was simply following the contour of the land. They had arrived. The berms. The wall of white loomed only an instant before they were on it. The blow to Rachel's side as they hit the incline drove the wind from her lungs and wrenched the axe from her hand. Like a tangled water skier being dragged up over a jump, Rachel felt her body dragged up the face of the berm and launched. She and Tallon were suddenly catapulted in a dizzying upward snarl. The trough between the berms spread out far beneath them, but the frayed payload cable held fast, lifting their accelerated bodies upward, carrying them clear out over the first trough. For an instant she glimpsed what lay ahead. 2 more berms, a short plateau, and then the drop-off to the sea. As if to give a voice to Rachel's own dumbstruck terror, the high-pitched scream of Corky Marlinson cut through the air. Somewhere behind them, he sailed up over the first berm. All three of them went airborne, the balloon clawing upward like a wild animal trying to break its captor's chains. Suddenly, like a gunshot in the night, a sudden snap echoed overhead. The frayed rope gave way, and the tattered end recoiled in Rachel's face. Instantly, they were falling. Somewhere overhead, the Mylar balloon billowed out of control, spiraling out to sea. Tangled in carabiners and harnesses, Rachel and Tolland tumbled back toward Earth. As the white mound of the second berm rose up toward them, Rachel braced for impact. Barely clearing the top of the second berm, they crashed down the far side, the blow partially cushioned by their suits and the descending contour of the berm. As the world around her turned into a blur of arms and legs and ice, Rachel felt herself rocketing down the incline, out onto the central ice trough. Instinctively, she spread her arms and legs, trying to slow down before they hit the next berm. She felt them slowing, but only slightly, and it seemed only a second before she and Tolland were sliding back up an incline. At the top, there was another instant of weightlessness as they cleared the crest. Then, filled with terror, Rachel felt them begin their dead slide down the other side and out onto the final plateau, the last 80 feet of the Milne Glacier. As they skidded toward the cliff, Rachel could feel the drag of Corky on the tether, and she knew they were all slowing down. She knew it was too little, too late. The end of the glacier raced toward them, and Rachel let out a helpless scream. Then it happened. The edge of the ice slid out from underneath them. The last thing Rachel remembered was falling. Chapter 54. The Westbrook Place apartments are located at 2201 N Street Northwest and promote themselves as one of the few unquestionably correct addresses in Washington. Gabrielle hurried through the gilded revolving door into the marble lobby, where a deafening waterfall reverberated. The doorman at the front desk looked surprised to see her.
"Miss Ash, I didn't know you were stopping by tonight."
"I'm running late."
Gabrielle quickly signed in. The clock overhead read 6:22 p.m. The doorman scratched his head.
"The senator gave me a list, but you weren't..."
"They always forget the people who help them most."
She gave a harried smile and strode past him toward the elevator. Now the doorman looked uneasy.
"I better call up."
"Thanks,"
Gabrielle said as she boarded the elevator and headed up. "The senator's phone is off the hook." Riding the elevator to the 9th floor, Gabrielle exited and made her way down the elegant hallway. At the end, outside Sexton's doorway, she could see one of his bulky personal safety escorts, glorified bodyguards, sitting in the hall. He looked bored. Gabrielle was surprised to see the security on duty, although apparently not as surprised as the guard was to see her. He jumped to his feet as she approached.
"I know," Gabrielle called out, still halfway down the hall. "It's a P.E. night. He doesn't want to be disturbed."
The guard nodded emphatically.
"He gave me very strict orders that no visitors..."
"It's emergency."
The guard physically blocked the doorway.
"He's in a private meeting."
"Really?"
Gabrielle pulled the red envelope from under her arm. She flashed the White House seal in the man's face.
"I was just in the Oval Office. I need to give the senator this information. Whatever old pals he's schmoozing tonight are going to have to do without him for a few minutes. Now, let me in."
The guard withered slightly at the sight of the White House seal on the envelope.
"Don't make me open this," Gabrielle thought.
"Leave the folder," he said. "I'll take it into him."
"The hell you will. I have direct orders from the White House to hand-deliver this. If I don't talk to him immediately, we can all start looking for jobs tomorrow morning. Do you understand?"
The guard looked deeply conflicted, and Gabrielle sensed the senator had indeed been unusually adamant tonight about having no visitors. She moved in for the kill. Holding the White House envelope directly in his face, Gabrielle lowered her voice to a whisper and uttered the 6 words all Washington security personnel feared most.
You do not understand the situation.
Security personnel for politicians never understood the situation, and they hated that fact. They were hired guns, kept in the dark, never sure whether to stand firm in their orders or risk losing their jobs by mule-headedly ignoring some obvious crisis. The guard swallowed hard, eyeing the White House envelope again.
Okay, but I'm telling the senator you demanded to be let in.
He unlocked the door, and Gabrielle pushed past him before he changed his mind. She entered the apartment and quietly closed the door behind her, relocking it. Now, inside the foyer, Gabrielle could hear muffled voices in Sexton's den down the hall. Men's voices. Tonight's P.E. was obviously not the private meeting implied by Sexton's earlier call. As Gabrielle moved down the hall toward the den, she passed an open closet where a half-dozen expensive men's coats hung inside, distinctive wool and tweed. Several briefcases sat on the floor. Apparently work stayed in the hall tonight. Gabrielle would have walked right past the cases except that one of the briefcases caught her eye. The nameplate bore a distinctive company logo, a bright red rocket. She paused, kneeling down to read it. Space America, Inc. Puzzled, she examined the other briefcases. Beale Aerospace. Microcosm, Inc. Rotary Rocket Company. Kistler Aerospace. Marjorie Tench's raspy voice echoed in her mind.
Are you aware that Sexton is accepting bribes from private aerospace companies?
Gabrielle's pulse began racing as she gazed down the darkened hallway toward the archway that led into the senator's den. She knew she should speak up, announce her presence, and yet she felt herself inching quietly forward. She moved to within a few feet of the archway and stood soundlessly in the shadows, listening to the conversation beyond. Chapter 55. While Delta III stayed behind to collect Nora Manger's body and the sled, the other two soldiers accelerated down the glacier after their quarry. On their feet they wore electro-tread-powered skis. Modeled after the consumer Fast Tracks motorized skis, the classified electro-treads were essentially snow skis with miniaturized tank treads affixed, like snowmobiles worn on the feet. Speed was controlled by pushing the tips of the index finger and thumb together, compressing two pressure plates inside the right-hand glove. A powerful gel battery was molded around the foot, doubling as insulation and allowing the skis to run silently. Ingeniously, the kinetic energy generated by gravity and the spinning treads as the wearer glided down a hill was automatically harvested to recharge the batteries for the next incline. Keeping the wind at his back, Delta One crouched low, skimming seaward as he surveyed the glacier before him. His night vision system was a far cry from the Patriot model used by the Marines. Delta One was looking through a hands-free face mount with a 40-by-90-millimeter six-element lens, three-element magnification doubler, and super-long-range IR. The world outside appeared in a translucent tint of cool blue rather than the usual green, the color scheme especially designed for highly reflected terrains like the Arctic. As he approached the first berm, Delta One's goggles revealed several bright stripes of freshly disturbed snow rising up and over the berm like a neon arrow in the night. Apparently the three escapees had either not thought to unhook their makeshift sail or had been unable to. Either way, if they hadn't released by the final berm, they were now somewhere out in the ocean. Delta One knew his quarry's protective clothing would lengthen the usual life expectancy in the water, but the relentless offshore currents would drag them out to sea. Drowning would be inevitable. Despite his confidence, Delta One had been trained never to assume. He needed to see bodies. Crouching low, he pressed his fingers together and accelerated up the first incline. Michael Tollan lay motionless, taking stock of his bruises. He was battered, but he sensed no broken bones. He had little doubt the gel-filled Mark IX had saved him any substantial trauma. As he opened his eyes, his thoughts were slow to focus. Everything seemed softer here, quieter. The wind still howled, but with less ferocity. We went over the edge, didn't we? Focusing, Tallon found he was lying on ice, draped across Rachel Sexton, almost at right angles, their locked carabiners twisted. He could feel her breathing beneath him, but he couldn't see her face. He rolled off her, his muscles barely responding. "Rachel!" Tallon wasn't sure if his lips were making sound or not. Tallon recalled the final seconds of their harrowing ride. The upward drag of the balloon, the payload cable snapping, their bodies plummeting down the far side of the berm, sliding up and over the final mound, skimming toward the edge, the ice running out. Tallon and Rachel had fallen, but the fall had been oddly short. Rather than the expected plunge to the sea, they had fallen only 10 feet or so before hitting another slab of ice and sliding to a stop with the dead weight of Corky in tow. Now, raising his head, Tallon looked toward the sea. Not far away, the ice ended in a sheer cliff, beyond which he could hear the sounds of the ocean. Looking back up the glacier, Tallon strained to see into the night. 20 yards back, his eyes met a high wall of ice, which seemed to hang above them. It was then that he realized what had happened. Somehow they had slid off the main glacier onto a lower terrace of ice. This section was flat, as large as a hockey rink, and had partially collapsed, preparing to cleave off into the ocean at any moment. Ice calving, Tallon thought, eyeing the precarious platform of ice on which he was now lying. It was a broad square slab that hung off the glacier like a colossal balcony, surrounded on three sides by precipices to the ocean. The sheet of ice was attached to the glacier only at its back, and Tallon could see the connection was anything but permanent. The boundary where the lower terrace clung to the Milne ice shelf was marked by a gaping pressure fissure almost 4 feet across. Gravity was well on its way to winning this battle. Almost more frightening than seeing the fissure was Tallon seeing the motionless body of Corky Marlinson crumpled on the ice. Corky lay 10 yards away at the end of a taut tether attached to them. Tallon tried to stand up, but he was still attached to Rachel. Repositioning himself, he began detaching their interlocking carabiners. Rachel looked weak as she tried to sit up.
"We didn't go over?"
Her voice was bewildered. "We fell onto a lower block of ice," Tallon said, finally unfastening himself from her. "I gotta help Corky." Painfully, Tallon attempted to stand, but his legs felt feeble. He grabbed the tether and heaved. Corky began sliding toward them across the ice. After a dozen or so pulls, Corky was lying on the ice a few feet away. Corky Marlinson looked beaten. He lost his goggles, suffered a bad cut on his cheek, and his nose was bleeding. Tallon's worries that Corky might be dead were quickly allayed when Corky rolled over and looked at Tallon with an angry glare.
"Jesus!" he stammered. "What the hell was that little trick?"
Tallon felt a wave of relief. Rachel sat up now, wincing. She looked around.
"We need to get off here. This block of ice looks like it's about to fall."
Tallon couldn't have agreed more. The only question was, how? They had no time to consider a solution. A familiar, high-pitched whir became audible above them on the glacier. Tallon's gaze shot up to see two white-clad figures ski effortlessly up onto the edge and stop in unison. The two men stood there a moment, peering down at their battered prey, like chess masters savoring checkmate before the final kill. Delta One was surprised to see the three escapees alive. He knew, however, this was a temporary condition. They had fallen into a section of the glacier that had already begun its inevitable plunge to the sea. This quarry could be disabled and killed in the same manner as the other woman, but a far cleaner solution had just presented itself, a way in which no bodies would ever be found. Gazing downward over the lip, Delta One focused on the gaping crevasse that had begun to spread like a wedge between the ice shelf and the clinging block of ice. The section of ice on which the three fugitives sat was dangerously perched, ready to break away and fall into the ocean any day now. Why not today? Here on the ice shelf, the night was rocked every few hours by deafening booms, the sound of ice cracking off parts of the glacier and plummeting into the ocean. Who would take notice? Feeling the familiar warm rush of adrenaline that accompanied the preparation for a kill, Delta One reached in a supply pack and pulled out a heavy, lemon-shaped object. Standard issue for military assault teams, the object was called a flashbang. A non-lethal concussion grenade that temporarily disoriented an enemy by generating a blinding flash and deafening concussion wave. Tonight, however, Delta One knew this flashbang would most certainly be lethal. He positioned himself near the edge and wondered how far the crevasse descended before tapering to a close. 20 feet? 50 feet? He knew it didn't matter. His plan would be effective regardless. With calm bred from the performance of countless executions, Delta One dialed a 10-second delay into the grenade's screw dial, slid out the pin, and threw the grenade down into the chasm. The bomb plummeted into the darkness and disappeared. Then Delta One and his partner cleared back up onto the top of the berm and waited. This would be a sight to behold. Even in her delirious state of mind, Rachel Sexton had a very good idea what the attackers had just dropped into the crevasse. Whether Michael Tolan also knew, or whether he was reading the fear in her eyes, was unclear. But she saw him go pale, shooting a horrified glance down at the mammoth slab of ice on which they were stranded, clearly realizing the inevitable. Like a storm cloud lit by an internal flash of lightning, the ice beneath Rachel illuminated from within. The eerie white translucence shot out in all directions. For 100 yards around them, the glacier flashed white. The concussion came next. Not a rumble like an earthquake, but a deafening shockwave of gut-churning force. Rachel felt the impact tearing up through the ice into her body. Instantly, as if a wedge had been driven between the ice shelf and the block of ice supporting them, the cliff began to shear off with a sickening crack. Rachel's eyes locked with Tolan's in a freeze frame of terror. Corky let out a scream nearby. The bottom dropped out. Rachel felt weightless for an instant, hovering over the multi-million-pound block of ice. Then they were riding the iceberg down, plummeting into the frigid sea. Chapter 56. The deafening grating of ice against ice assaulted Rachel's ears as the massive slab slid down the face of the Milne ice shelf, sending towering plumes of spray into the air. As the slab splashed downward, it slowed, and Rachel's previously weightless body crashed down onto the top of the ice. Tolland and Corky landed hard nearby. As the block's downward momentum plunged it deeper into the sea, Rachel could see the foaming surface of the ocean racing upward with a kind of taunting deceleration, like the ground beneath a bungee jumper whose cord was a few feet too long. Rising, rising, and then it was there. Her childhood nightmare was back. The ice, the water, the darkness. The dread was almost primal. The top of the slab slipped below the waterline, and the frigid Arctic Ocean poured over the edges in a torrent. As the ocean rushed in all around her, Rachel felt herself sucked under. The bare skin on her face tightened and burned as the salt water hit. The flooring of ice disappeared beneath her, and Rachel fought her way back to the surface, buoyed by the gel in her suit. She took in a mouthful of salt water, sputtering to the surface. She could see the others floundering nearby, all of them tangled in tethers. Just as Rachel righted herself, Tolan yelled out, "It's coming back up!" As his words echoed above the tumult, Rachel felt an eerie upwelling in the water beneath her. Like a massive locomotive straining to reverse direction, the slab of ice had grown to a stop underwater and was now beginning its ascent directly beneath them. Fathoms below, a sickening low-frequency rumble resonated upward through the water as the gigantic submerged sheet began scraping its way back up the face of the glacier. The slab rose fast, accelerating as it came, swooping up from the darkness. Rachel felt herself rising. The ocean roiled all around as the ice met her body. She scrambled in vain, trying to find her balance as the ice propelled her skyward along with millions of gallons of seawater. Buoying upward, the giant sheet bobbed above the surface, heaving and teetering, looking for its center of gravity. Rachel found herself scrambling in waist-deep water across the enormous, flat expanse. As the water began pouring off the surface, the current swallowed Rachel and dragged her toward the edge. Sliding, splayed flat on her stomach, Rachel could see the edge looming fast. "Hold on!" Rachel's mother's voice was calling the same way it had when Rachel was just a child floundering beneath the icy pond. "Hold on! Don't go under!" The wrenching yank on her harness expelled what little air Rachel had left in her lungs. She jerked to a dead stop, only yards from the edge. The motion spun her in place. 10 yards away, she could see Corky's limp body, still tethered to her, also jolting to a stop. They had been flowing off the sheet in opposite directions, and his momentum had stopped her. As the water ran off and grew more shallow, another dark form appeared over near Corky. He was on his hands and knees, grasping Corky's tether and vomiting salt water. Michael Tolland. As the last of the wake drained past her and flowed off the iceberg, Rachel lay in terrified silence, listening to the sounds of the ocean. Then, feeling the onset of deadly cold, she dragged herself onto her hands and knees. The berg was still bobbing back and forth like a giant ice cube. Delirious and in pain, she crawled back toward the others. High above on the glacier, Delta One peered through his night vision goggles at the water churning around the Arctic Ocean's newest tabular iceberg. Although he saw no bodies in the water, he wasn't surprised. The ocean was dark, and his quarry's weather suits and skullcaps were black. As he passed his gaze across the surface of the enormous floating sheet of ice, he had a hard time keeping it in focus. It was receding quickly, already heading out to sea in the strong offshore currents. He was about to turn his gaze back to the sea when he saw something unexpected. 3 specks of black on the ice. "Are those bodies?" Delta One tried to bring them into focus. "See something?" Delta Two asked. Delta One said nothing, focusing in with his magnifier. In the pale tint of the iceberg, he was stunned to see 3 human forms huddled motionless on the island of ice. Whether they were alive or dead, Delta One had no idea. It hardly mattered. If they were alive, even in weather suits, they'd be dead within the hour. They were wet. A storm was coming in, and they were drifting seaward into one of the most deadly oceans on the planet. Their bodies would never be found. "Just shadows," Delta One said, turning from the cliff. "Let's get back to base."
Chapter 57 Senator Sedgwick Sexton set his snifter of Courvoisier on the mantelpiece of his Westbrook apartment and stoked the fire for several moments, gathering his thoughts. The 6 men in the den with him sat in silence now, waiting. The small talk was over. It was time for Senator Sexton to make his pitch. They knew it, he knew it. Politics was sales. Establish trust. Let them know you understand their problems. "As you may know," Sexton said, turning toward them, "over the past months I have met with many men in your same position." He smiled and sat down, joining them on their level. "You are the only ones I have ever brought into my home. You are extraordinary men, and I'm honored to meet you." Sexton folded his hands and let his eyes circle the room, making personal contact with each of his guests. Then he focused in on his first mark— the heavyset man on the cowboy hat. "Space Industries of Houston," Sexton said. "I'm glad you came." The Texan grunted. "I hate this town." "I don't blame you. Washington has been unfair to you." The Texan stared out from beneath the rim of his hat, but said nothing. 12 years back, Sexton began, "you made an offer to the U.S. government. You proposed to build them a U.S. space station for a mere $5 billion. "Yeah, I did. I still have the blueprints." And yet NASA convinced the government that a U.S. space station should be a NASA project.
Right. NASA started building almost a decade ago.
A decade. And not only is the NASA space station not yet fully operational, but the project so far has cost 20 times your bid.
As an American taxpayer, I am sickened.
A grumble of agreement circled the room. Sexton let his eyes move, reconnecting with the group.
I am well aware, the senator said, addressing everyone now, that several of your companies have offered to launch private space shuttles for as little as $50 million per flight.
More nods.
And yet NASA undercuts you by charging only $38 million per flight, even though their actual per-flight cost is over $150 million. It's how they keep us out of space, one of the men said. The private sector cannot possibly compete with a company that can afford to run shuttle flights at 400% loss and still stay in business.
Nor should you have to, Sexton said. Nods all around. Sexton turned now to the austere entrepreneur beside him, a man whose files Sexton had read with interest. Like many of the entrepreneurs funding Sexton's campaign, this man was a former military engineer who had become disillusioned with low wages and government bureaucracy and had abandoned his military post to seek his fortune in aerospace.
Kistler Aerospace, Sexton said, shaking his head in despair. Your company has designed and manufactured a rocket that can launch payloads for as little as $2,000 per pound. Compared to NASA's costs of $10,000 per pound,
Sexton paused for effect.
And yet, you have no clients.
Why would I have any clients? The man replied. Last week, NASA undercut us by charging Motorola only $812 per pound to launch a telecom satellite. The government launched that satellite at 900% loss. Sexton nodded. Taxpayers were unwittingly subsidizing an agency that was 10 times less efficient than its competition.
It has become painfully clear, he said, his voice darkening, that NASA is working very hard to stifle competition in space. They crowd out private aerospace businesses by pricing services below market value. It's the Walmart of space, the Texan said.
Damn good analogy, Sexton thought. I'll have to remember that.
Walmart was notorious for moving into a new territory, selling products below market value and driving all local competition out of business. I'm goddamn sick and tired, the Texan said, of having to pay millions in business taxes so Uncle Sam can use that money to steal my clients.
I hear you, Sexton said. I understand.
It's the lack of corporate sponsorships that's killing Rotary Rocket, a sharply dressed man said. The laws against sponsorship are criminal.
I couldn't agree more.
Sexton had been shocked to learn that another way NASA entrenched its monopoly of space was by passing federal mandates banning advertisements on space vehicles. Instead of allowing private companies to secure funding through corporate sponsorships and advertising logos, the way, for example, professional race car drivers did, space vehicles could only display the words USA and the company name. In a country that spent $185 billion a year on advertising, not one advertising dollar ever found its way into the coffers of private space companies.
It's robbery,
one of the men snapped. My company hopes to stay in business long enough to launch the country's first tourist shuttle prototype next May. We expect enormous press coverage. The Nike Corporation just offered us $7 million in sponsorship dollars to paint the Nike swoosh and Just Do It on the side of the shuttle. Pepsi offered us twice that for Pepsi, the choice of a new generation. But according to federal law, if our shuttle displays advertising, we're prohibited from launching it.
That's right, Senator Sexton said.
And if elected, I will work to abolish that anti-sponsorship legislation. That is a promise. Space should be open for advertising the way every square inch of Earth is open to advertising.
Sexton gazed out now at his audience, his eyes locking in, his voice growing solemn.
We all need to be aware, however, that the biggest obstacle to privatization of NASA is not laws, but rather it is public perception. Most Americans still hold a romanticized view of the American space program.
they still believe NASA is a necessary government agency.
It's those goddamn Hollywood movies, one man said. How many NASA saves the world from a killer asteroid movies can Hollywood make, for Christ's sake? It's propaganda.
The plethora of NASA movies coming out of Hollywood, Sexton knew, was simply a matter of economics. Following the wildly popular movie Top Gun, a Tom Cruise jet pilot blockbuster that played like a 2-hour advertisement for the U.S. Navy, NASA realized the true potential of Hollywood as a public relations powerhouse. NASA quietly began offering film companies free filming access to all of NASA's dramatic facilities, launch pads, mission control, training facilities. Producers, who were accustomed to paying enormous on-site licensing fees when they filmed anywhere else, jumped at the opportunity to save millions in budget costs by making NASA thrillers on free sets. Of course, Hollywood only got access if NASA approved the script.
Public brainwashing, a Hispanic grunted. The movies aren't half as bad as the publicity stunts. Sending a senior citizen into space? And now NASA is planning an all-female shuttle crew, all for publicity.
Sexton sighed, his tone turning tragic.
True. And I know I don't have to remind you what happened back in the 80s, when the Department of Education was bankrupt and cited NASA as wasting millions that could be spent on education. NASA devised a PR stunt to prove NASA was education-friendly. They sent a public school teacher into space.
Sexton paused.
You all remember Krista McAuliffe.
The room fell silent.
Gentlemen, Sexton said, stopping dramatically in front of the fire, I believe it is time Americans understood the truth, for the good of all our futures. It's time Americans understand that NASA is not leading us skyward, but rather is stifling space exploration. Space is no different than any other industry, and keeping the private sector grounded verges on a criminal act. Consider the computer industry, in which we see such an explosion of progress that we can barely keep up from week to week. Why? Because the computer industry is a free market system. It rewards efficiency and vision with profits. Imagine if the computer industry were government run. We would still be in the dark ages. We're stagnating in space. We should put space exploration into the hands of the private sector where it belongs. Americans would be stunned by the growth, jobs, and realized dreams. I believe we should let the free market system spur us to new heights in space. If elected, I will make it my personal mission to unlock the doors to the final frontier and let them swing wide open.
Sexton lifted his snifter of cognac.
My friends, you came here tonight to decide if I am someone worthy of your trust. I hope I am on the way to earning it. In the same way it takes investors to build a company, it takes investors to build a presidency. In the same way corporate stockholders expect returns, you as political investors expect returns. My message to you tonight is simple. Invest in me, and I will never forget you. Ever. Our missions are one and the same.
Sexton extended his glass toward them in a toast.
With your help, my friends, soon I will be in the White House, and you will all be launching your dreams.
Only 15 feet away, Gabrielle Ash stood in the shadows, rigid. From the den came the harmonious clink of crystal snifters and the crackle of the fire. Chapter 58. In a panic, the young NASA technician dashed through the habosphere. Something terrible has happened. He found Administrator Ekstrom alone near the press area.
Sir, the technician gasped, running up. There's been an accident.
Ekstrom turned, looking distant, as if his thoughts were already deeply troubled with other matters.
What did you say? An accident? Where?
In the extraction pit. A body just floated up. Dr. Weili Ming.
Ekstrom's face was blank.
Dr. Ming, but...
We pulled him out, but it was too late. He's dead.
For Christ's sake. How long has he been in there?
We think about an hour. It looks like he fell in, sank to the bottom, but when his body bloated, he floated up again.
Ekstrom's reddish skin turned crimson.
God damn it! Who else knows about this?
Nobody, sir. Only two of us. We fished him out, but we thought we'd better tell you before...
You did the right thing.
Ekstrom exhaled a weighty sigh.
Stow Dr. Ming's body immediately. Say nothing.
The technician felt perplexed.
But, sir, I...
Ekstrom put a large hand on the man's shoulder.
Listen to me carefully. This is a tragic accident, one I deeply regret. Of course, I will deal with it appropriately when the time comes. Now, however, is not the time.
You want me to hide his body?
Ekstrom's cold Nordic eyes bore down.
Think about it. We could tell everyone, but what would that accomplish? We're about an hour off from this press conference. Announcing that we've had a fatal accident would overshadow the discovery and have a devastating effect on morale. Dr. Ming made a careless mistake. I have no intention of making NASA pay for it. These civilian scientists have taken enough of the spotlight without me letting one of their slipshod errors cast a shadow over our public moment of glory. Dr. Ming's accident remains a secret until after the press conference. Do you understand?
The man nodded, pale.
I'll stow his body.
Chapter 59. Michael Tolland had been at sea enough times to know the ocean took victims without remorse or hesitation. As he lay in exhaustion on the expansive sheet of ice, he could just make out the ghostly outline of the towering Milne ice shelf receding in the distance. He knew the powerful Arctic current flowing off the Elizabethan Islands spiraled in an enormous loop around the polar ice cap and would eventually skirt land in northern Russia. Not that it mattered. That would be months from now. We've got maybe 30 minutes, 45 at the most. Without the protective insulation of their gel-filled suits, Tolland knew they would be dead already. Thankfully, the Mark 9s had kept them dry, the most critical aspect of surviving cold weather. The thermal gel around their bodies had not only cushioned their fall, but it was now helping their bodies retain what little heat they had left. Soon, hypothermia would set in. It would start with a vague numbness in limbs as the blood retreated to the body's core to protect the critical internal organs. Delirious hallucinations would come next, as the pulse and respiration slowed, cheating the brain of oxygen. Then the body would make a final effort to conserve its remaining heat by shutting down all operations except the heart and respiration. Unconsciousness would follow. In the end, heart and respiration centers in the brain would stop functioning altogether. Tolland turned his gaze toward Rachel, wishing he could do something to save her. The numbness spreading through Rachel Sexton's body was less painful than she would have imagined. Almost a welcome anesthetic. Nature's morphine. She had lost her goggles in the collapse, and she could barely open her eyes against the cold. She could see Tolland and Corky on the ice nearby. Tolland was looking at her, eyes filled with regret. Corky was moving, but obviously in pain. His right cheekbone was smashed and bloody. Rachel's body trembled wildly as her mind searched for answers. Who? Why? Her thoughts were muddled by a growing heaviness inside her. Nothing was making sense. She felt like her body was slowly shutting down, lulled by an invisible force pulling her to sleep. She fought it. A fiery anger ignited within her now, and she tried to fan the flames. They tried to kill us. She peered out at the threatening sea and sensed their attackers had succeeded. We're already dead. Even now, knowing she would probably not live to learn the whole truth about the deadly game being played out on the Milne ice shelf, Rachel suspected she already knew who to blame. Administrator Ekstrom had the most to gain. He was the one who sent them out on the ice. He had ties to the Pentagon and special ops. But what did Ekstrom have to gain by inserting the meteorite beneath the ice? What did anyone have to gain? Rachel flashed on Zach Herney, wondering if the president was a co-conspirator or an unknowing pawn. Herney knows nothing. He's innocent. The president obviously had been duped by NASA. Now Herney was only about an hour away from making NASA's announcement, and he would do so armed with a video documentary containing endorsements from 4 civilian scientists. 4 dead civilian scientists. Rachel could do nothing to stop the press conference now, but she vowed that whoever was responsible for this attack would not get away with it. Summoning her strength, Rachel tried to sit up. Her limbs felt like granite, all her joints screaming in pain as she bent her legs and arms. Slowly she pulled herself to her knees, steadying herself on the flat ice. Her head spun. All around her, the ocean churned. Tallon lay nearby, gazing up at her with inquisitive eyes. Rachel sensed he probably thought she was kneeling in prayer. She wasn't, of course, although prayer probably had as good a chance of saving them as what she was about to attempt. Rachel's right hand fumbled across her waist and found the ice axe still bungeed to her belt. Her stiff fingers gripped the handle. She inverted the axe, positioning it like an upside-down T. Then with all her energy, she drove the butt downward into the ice. Thud. Again. Thud. The blood felt like cold molasses in her veins. Thud. Tallon looked on in obvious confusion. Rachel drove the axe down again. Thud. Tallon tried to lift himself onto his elbow. Rachel. She didn't answer. She needed all her energy. Thud. Thud. I don't think, Tallon said, this far north, that the SAA could hear. Rachel turned, surprised. She had forgotten Tallon was an oceanographer and might have some idea what she was up to. Right idea, but I'm not calling the SAA. She kept pounding. The SAA stood for a suboceanic acoustic array, a relic of the Cold War now used by oceanographers worldwide to listen for whales. Because underwater sounds carried for hundreds of miles, the SAA network of 59 underwater microphones around the world could listen to a surprisingly large percentage of the planet's oceans. Unfortunately, this remote section of the Arctic was not part of that percentage. But Rachel knew there were others out there listening to the ocean floor, others that few on Earth knew existed. She kept pounding. Her message was simple and clear. Thud, thud, thud. Thud, thud, thud. Thud, thud, thud. Rachel had no delusions that her actions would save their lives. She could already feel a frosty tightness gripping her body. She doubted she had a half hour of life left in her. Rescue was beyond the realm of possibility now. But this was not about rescue. Thud, thud, thud. Thud, thud, thud. Thud, thud, thud. There's no time, Tallon said. It's not about us, she thought. It's about the information in my pocket. Rachel pictured the incriminating GPR printout inside the Velcro pocket of her Mark IX suit. I need to get the GPR printout into the hands of the NRO, and soon. Even in her delirious state, Rachel was certain her message would be received. In the mid-80s, the NRO had replaced the SAA with an array 30 times as powerful. Total global coverage. Classic wizard. The NRO's $12 million ear to the ocean floor. In the next few hours, the Cray supercomputers at the NRO NSA listening post in Menwith Hill, England, would flag an anomalous sequence in one of the Arctic's hydrophones, decipher the pounding as an SOS, triangulate the coordinates, and dispatch a rescue plane from Thule Air Force Base in Greenland. The plane would find 3 bodies on an iceberg, frozen, dead. One would be an NRO employee, and she would be carrying a strange piece of thermal paper in her pocket. A GPR printout. Nora Manger's final legacy. When the rescuers studied the printout, the mysterious insertion tunnel beneath the meteorite would be revealed. From there, Rachel had no idea what would happen, but at least the secret would not die with them here on the ice. Chapter 60. Every president's transition into the White House involves a private tour of three heavily guarded warehouses containing priceless collections of past White House furniture, desks, silverware, bureaus, beds, and other items used by past presidents as far back as George Washington. During the tour, the transitioning president is invited to select any heirlooms he likes and use them as furnishings inside the White House during his term. Only the bed in the Lincoln bedroom is a permanent White House fixture. Ironically, Lincoln never slept in it. The desk at which Zach Herney was currently sitting inside the Oval Office had once belonged to his idol, Harry Truman. The desk, though small by modern standards, served as a daily reminder to Zach Herney that the buck did indeed stop here, and that Herney was ultimately responsible for any shortcomings of his administration. Herney accepted the responsibility as an honor, and did his best to instill in his staff the motivations to do whatever it took to get the job done. "Mr. President," his secretary called out, peering into the office, "your call just went through." Herney waved. "Thank you." He reached for his phone. He would have preferred some privacy for this call, but he sure as hell wasn't going to get any of that right now. Two makeup specialists hovered like gnats, poking and primping at his face and hair. Directly in front of his desk, a television crew was setting up, and an endless swarm of advisors and PR people scurried around the office, excitedly discussing strategy. Tea minus 1 hour. Herney pressed the illuminated button on his private phone. "Lawrence, you there?"
"I'm here."
The NASA administrator's voice sounded consumed, distant.
"Everything okay up there?" "Storm's still moving in, but my people tell me the satellite link will not be affected. We're good to go. 1 hour and counting."
"Excellent.
Spirits high, I hope." "Very high. My staff's excited. In fact, we just shared some beers."
Herney laughed.
"Glad to hear it. Look, I wanted to call and thank you before we do this thing. Tonight's going to be one hell of a night."
The administrator paused, sounding uncharacteristically uncertain.
"That it will, sir. We've been waiting a long time for this."
Herney hesitated.
"You sound exhausted." "I need some sunlight and a real bed." "One more hour. Smile for the cameras, enjoy the moment, and then we'll get a plane up there to bring you back to D.C. Looking forward to it."
The man fell silent again. As a skilled negotiator, Herney was trained to listen, to hear what was being said between the lines. Something in the administrator's voice sounded off somehow.
"You sure everything's okay up there?" "Absolutely. All systems go."
The administrator seemed eager to change the subject.
"Did you see the final cut of Michael Tollin's documentary?"
"Just watched it,"
Herney said. "He did a fantastic job."
"Yes. You made a good call bringing him in." "Still mad at me for involving civilians?" "Hell yes,"
the administrator growled good-naturedly, his voice with the usual strength to it. It made Herney feel better.
"Ekstrom's fine," Herney thought, "just a little tired." "Okay, I'll see you in an hour via satellite. We'll give him something to talk about." "Right. Hey, Lawrence."
Herney's voice grew low and solemn now.
"You've done a hell of a thing up there. I won't ever forget it."
Outside the Habosphere, buffeted by wind, Delta III struggled to right and repack Nora Manger's toppled equipment sled. Once all the equipment was back on board, he battened down the vinyl top and draped Manger's dead body across the top, tying her down. As he was preparing to drag the sled off course, his two partners came skimming up the glacier toward him.
"Change of plans," Delta One called out above the wind. "The other three went over the edge."
Delta III wasn't surprised. He also knew what it meant. The Delta Force's plan to stage an accident by arranging four dead bodies on the ice shelf was no longer a viable option. Leaving a lone body would pose more questions than answers.
"Sweep?"
he asked. Delta One nodded.
I'll recover the flares, and you two get rid of the sled. While Delta One carefully retraced the scientist's path, collecting every last clue that anyone had been there at all, Delta Three and his partner moved down the glacier with the laden equipment sled. After struggling over the berms,